Good afternoon. The first case on this panel's agenda this afternoon for oral argument is Ventura v. Ganser, MD, case number 81850. Counsel, are you ready to proceed, Mr. Krosky?
Yes, Your Honor.
Forgive me, I may have mispronounced your last name. Would you please restate it for us?
Sure. Neil Krakowski.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Mercado?
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, counsel, for accommodating the court. We had a little health issue that developed that we didn't want to expose anybody to. So Justice Herndon is in Las Vegas in the courtroom down there, and Justice Stiglitz and I are located in Carson City for this argument. All right, you may proceed then, Mr. Krakowski.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Neil Krakowski, and I have the pleasure of representing the appellant, Mr. David Alvarez Ventura. I would appreciate the reserving 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Yes, sir, of course.
This is the quintessential retained object case. Mr. Ventura filed a verified complaint, a complaint that he signed under penalty of perjury consistent with NRS 53.045, in which he alleged that Dr. Ganser performed surgery on him on October 24, 2016. In addition to alleging that Dr. Ganser performed surgery, Mr. Ventura repeatedly alleged in his verified complaint that during that surgery, Dr. Ganser and his surgical team unintentionally left an object in him during that procedure. Those allegations, Mr. Ventura's allegations, are functionally identical to what the court has previously found sufficient in the case of Zeidel, where there was a retained needle, and much more recently, 2 months before Ganser and Gomez filed their motion to dismiss in this case, in Jaramillo, where the allegation was that the surgeon left a wire in in Ms. Jaramillo's breast. Although unnecessary, it is also noteworthy that Mr. Ventura specifically alleged the applicability of res ipsa loquitur in this particular case in paragraph 9 of his complaint, which is found on joint appendix page 005. The easiest path for this court to take in reviewing this case is to look at the one and only argument that Ganser and Gomez advanced in their motion to dismiss, which was their classification of this case as a medical malpractice case and their argument that every medical malpractice case requires an expert affidavit. In his response, Mr. Ventura very clearly identified Zeidel in the exception under NRS 41A.100 sub 1 sub A. At that point in time, if the court just needs to look at the reply filed by Ganser and Gomez, and they say essentially nothing about the applicability of Zeidel. They simply say it's distinguishable on the facts. They don't comment on the court's reasoning, on the court's reasoning whatsoever. I think if the district court stopped there, as I indicated earlier, I think that the dismissal was inappropriate and the district court would have denied that motion. In this appeal, Dr. Ganser and Gomez make no effort to try to resurrect their original classification equals affidavit argument. Rather, they make three new arguments. With respect to each of those three arguments, we've spent a lot of time in the reply brief articulating why, in our opinion, those argues were are not properly before this court, talking about issues of due process, preservation, and waiver. I don't mean to belabor the point, so I'm not going to make those arguments in greater detail today.
Counsel, this is Justice Hardesty. I've got a couple of questions for you, and I think maybe other justices may as well, but let me begin. I would suggest that you need not waste your time on the three arguments you mentioned. I want to focus on what the district court did when it considered the motion and after it considered the comments in reply. I assume you agree that under Sizedale, to which, of course, as you know, I dissented, the court allows for, on a motion to dismiss in this context, a requirement for the person who raises res ipsa, the duty or the responsibility to make a prima facie showing that res ipsa applies. Now, on page 94 of the record, the district court goes to some length to demonstrate why, in its view, your client failed to make that showing. It said, of course, that this was a laparoscopic in surgery, which raises an interesting question about whether there were any needles used at all. Secondly, it notes that the instrument was removed from an entirely different area of the plaintiff's body, failed to appear on the ultrasound performed a year after surgery. The ultrasound that first identified the instrument occurred 2 years after the alleged malpractice and 1 year after the first ultrasound. And the report of the second ultrasound states that the presence of the instrument is unlikely related to the surgery performed. To those items, I would add, there is no showing that a needle was even used in the laparoscopic surgery, and further, that it was left by Ganser. It seems to me that in the absence of those two requirements, Sizedale would support the conclusion that your client did not make a prima facie showing. Could you comment on this long-winded, and I apologize for that question, and we'll give you an extra minute to respond.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. No problem. First, I do not read the Sizedale opinion as requiring the presentation of evidence in opposition to a motion to dismiss. I think that interpretation is inconsistent with Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure 8 and 9, as well as what this court did find sufficient in the Jaramillo case, specifically with respect to the pleading, the comments about the pleading. That being said, I think that the district court inverted the standard of review in this particular case. It's the district court, as this court is aware, was obligated to take all allegations in the light most favorable to Mr. Ventura. And so if I may walk through what I believe responds to your question, Justice, is there's no dispute that Dr. Ganser performed a surgery, a robotic Heller esophageomyotomy. And we have a part of the medical record attached to Mr. Ventura's complaint. It is true a year later that Mr. Ventura undergoes an ultrasound. It looks like that ultrasound was focused on the right upper quadrant based upon the anatomical structures that were being discussed. We do not know anything further about that. There's no discussion. There's nothing in the record about whether that ultrasound was able or capable to identify where this object was ultimately located, being over the left hip. We have no knowledge of whether this object was actually located by the reading physician, and he simply chose not to write it down. Those are typically the things that we would find in the context of discovery. The second part is with respect to the subsequent x-ray and this issue that there's an unlikely relationship between the object and the surgery. Here again, I think the district court inverted the standard of review, making assumptions about what this physician knew. There's no indication in the record about this that doctor's knowledge, training, experience, or even his familiarity with respect to the issue of this particular surgery. In addition, that record in and of itself wouldn't be admissible under the reasonable probability standard. So I think that there are good arguments to be made. Again, items that we would typically discuss and address during discovery. The final part of the answer to your question is, I do believe that Mr. Ventura did make the requisite showing. I think he attached the operative note from Dr. Ganser. That note indicated that there were no complications, and ultimately he produced the report of an imaging study that referenced not one but two studies that identified a foreign object and a subsequent surgery that removed it. We don't know if it's a needle or a part of an instrument. Again, those are things that would be typically looked at through discovery, but I do believe he made that showing consistent with this court's decision in Jaramillo. And so that's...
If I could kind of jump in here, because I had a similar concern, and this is Justice Herndon in Las Vegas, to Justice Hardesty's question about the object that's alleged to have been left in the body and then removed in 2019. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I can't see anywhere anybody has determined what that object was. And so it would seem to me that kind of a predicate to alleging that an object was left in my body by surgery would be somebody telling us what that object was. But the basic of my question is, do you believe under Sizedale, that when the court said there is some evidence required, that that can include the necessity of an expert affidavit, even in a Ray Zipsa case?
I don't believe Sizedale leaves it open with respect to the expert affidavit issue. I think that's the distinction drawn between the majority and Justice Hardesty's dissent. And I think that subsequent to the Sizedale case, it's been consistently applied, including by Justice Hardesty, not only in Jaramillo, but in Cummings versus Barber decided the same day. So I don't think Sizedale leaves open the potential necessity of an expert affidavit in a statutory res ipsa case, number one. Number two, I also think that it's important to look at what Mr. Ventura alleged. The sole source of the object that he alleged in his complaint is the surgery performed by Dr. Ganser in October of 2016. Again, if we take those allegations at face value, which I believe the standard requires us to do, whether they ultimately are correct or incorrect, I believe that he has stated enough to connect the dots between the Ganser surgery and the object that's left inside of him.
Mr. Kirkoski, if I could jump in. With respect to count one is the res ipsa claim, I have the pleading in front of me. I see what's there. I want to focus briefly on count two. Isn't count two, why wouldn't count two be subject to the affidavit requirement? Because now you're asking a jury or a lay person to evaluate essentially the way a surgical thing is set up, the way somebody's supervising surgery. How do you try to fit that into res ipsa, the res ipsa statute, and say that one doesn't need an affidavit either?
So that Justice Stiglitz, I appreciate that. I think the court's answered that question in Zimborski, that I think that in both instances, if the underlying facts are subject to the statutory res ipsa presumption or the exception, depending on what you want to call it, I think that both fit within that statutory exception. I think that's the first part of the argument. Now, the second part of the argument, and admittedly Mr. Ventura did not make the argument below, is that I think you have an instance where you also have a common knowledge type argument under both Zimborski as well as a state of Curtis subsequently, when you're talking about a situation of, for example, did the surgical team count the instruments that they used during the procedure and after them? Were they equal? Did they look at whether the instruments were in operative condition before and after? So I think that not only does it qualify under the statutory presumption for a retained object, which is the basis of the claim, I also think that there's a common knowledge argument as well. And I'm happy to take any more questions, but my time is running short, so I'd like to save it for rebuttal if I could.
Okay, Mr. Kirkoski, thank you very much for your response to the questions. We'll add a minute to your time on rebuttal. You'll have 2:47 when you rebut. All right, let's go ahead with Ms. Mercado.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Alice Mercado of Lemons, Grundy & Eisenberg for respondents, Dr. John Ganser and Western Surgical Group. We're asking the court today to affirm the district court's order for many of the reasons that the court has outlined already in its questioning. But first of all, the district court did apply the correct standard under NRCP 12b5 in resolving the motion to dismiss. Secondly, the district court correctly determined that an expert affidavit was required because the res ipsa exception did not apply under the facts of this case, given the record before it. And third, the district court properly denied leave to amend, as it was required to do by Washoe Medical Center. Now, I think one of the important questions that was asked is whether or not a prima facie case has been stated in this complaint. And one of the things that the court looks at in evaluating a motion to dismiss is not just the complaint, but any exhibits that are attached to it. Those exhibits become part of the complaint for all purposes. Now, in looking and evaluating whether or not a claim has been stated, the court looked at all of those things, and all of the things that are pointed out in the court's, the district court's order at page 94 of the appendix, they all contradicted everything that the conclusory allegations that were made in the complaint.
Well, Ms.
There's
Mercado,
nothing in the complaint.
Ms. Mercado, let me.
Yes.
I'm sorry, it's weird on video. Let me just hold you up for 1 second. So, sans the exhibits, do you agree that this complaint contained a prima facie, at least for a notice pleading state, noticed a res ipsa loquitur claim that would not have required an affidavit? Count one, at least. Let's just say count one.
Sure. I do not, for two reasons. First of all, we're looking at NRCP 8A2. And we're and understand this is a notice pleading state, but NRCP 8A2 says that in order to state a claim, the plaintiff must give a short and plain statement showing that he is entitled to relief. The complaint that we have here, sans the exhibits, does not show that he is entitled to relief. He says that the surgery happened in 2016, somebody found something in 2019, but there's no indication, unlike Jaramillo and unlike Cummings, there's no indication of how that instrument got there.
But he said Dr. Gansert left. He said Dr. Gansert left a foreign metal object in my body. So this is just, how is that insufficient? And a pleading stage.
Well, sure. And if we look back at Jaramillo and at Cummings, in those cases, the plaintiffs pleaded, I had this particular surgery. This was the mechanism by which the foreign object was left behind, and because of that, it falls into Section A of NRS 41A101. So there are at least those types of allegations in those complaints, and you know both of them ended up on summary judgment. But even at the pleading stage, those complainants, those plaintiffs, alleged this was the surgery, this is what happened, this is what was left behind, and with that, you have the basis for a rebuttable presumption because it's showing now some evidence that a foreign object was unintentionally left behind. Now, in Zeidel, of course, the court is talking about an exception to the affidavit requirement, but even so, they're doing it based on NRS 41A100, which does require some evidence. And it says, present facts or some evidence that you're entitled to that rebuttable presumption. This complaint on its own does not do that. Because if you look at the complaint, it has the same contradictions as the exhibits. Because in the complaint, he says, I had the surgery in 2016, something was left behind. But in 2017, they didn't find anything when I had upper quadrant pain. And he says it within the complaint. You know, never mind the exhibits. And then later on, he says, and then I had another imaging study in 2018, 2 years post-surgery, but that radiologist said, you know, it's unlikely related. And so this is in the body of the complaint. And in light of that, it was entirely proper for the district court to say, you have not stated a claim under the res ipsa doctrine. Going back to the notice pleading aspect of it, in Zohar, the court said, the purpose of a complaint is to give fair notice of the nature and basis of a legally sufficient claim. This complaint does not do that, even if you ignore the exhibits. The exhibits cannot be ignored because in Baxter versus Dignity Health, the court said the exhibits are part of the complaint for all purposes. So in light of that...
How does it count one and not give notice? It says which surgery, which actor, what something was left behind. I mean, how does that not give notice to Dr. Gansert to defend that count? I mean, it's imperfect, but 12b-5, is that's out the gate. I'm not saying this as a summary judgment motion where I have an entirely different conversation, but we're talking about, before anything's happened, we're talking about a motion to dismiss this complaint out the gate.
Sure. And even under Zeidel, which was a motion to dismiss under 12b-5, the court said you have to have some evidence, because they're making a distinction between, okay, the expert affidavit requirement, you know, it's there to ensure that frivolous claims are not pursued, that meritless claims are dismissed of early on. And then you've got 41A100, which talks about presenting some evidence. So even at that stage, there has to be something to connect the dots. These dots have never been connected. And one of the things that Justice Herndon pointed out, we don't know that it's a needle. We don't know how a needle in a laparoscopic surgery that was done by a robot, it was a robotic surgery, how do we even get a needle in there? So there's a lot of leaps that you have to make, and although there can be reasonable inferences made, that is not a reasonable inference that because there's a surgery in 2016 and there's an object 2 years later, that these two are connected. So the mere fact that somebody says something, a conclusory allegation is not enough to even meet the notice pleading standard that Nevada employed. So that would be the reason why I don't think that it would apply. The district court is looking at the entirety of the complaint and weighing not evidence, but looking at this is what you said, but this is what the evidence is that you presented. You have presented no evidence, not even facts, that connect the dots that lead to a rebuttable presumption, which under 41A100-1A, also requires some evidence.
But it would seem that a generous interpretation of Zeidel, when they talk about some evidence with respect to pleadings, to then just determine that goes back to something needing to be attached to a 12b-5 or some pleading requirement, when they could have said that. I mean, that one interpretation would be that you got to, at some point in the pleadings, you have to come up with it, or if it's challenged, but that seemed to be a time when they could have said, hey, on res ipsa loquitur, we have a heightened pleading standard under 12b-5, and do we? Is that what you're, are you suggesting that after Zeidel we have a heightened pleading standard in res ipsa cases?
Well, what the Zeidel court actually says is any res ipsa claim filed without an expert affidavit must, when challenged by the defendant in a pretrial or trial motion, meet the prima facie requirements for a res ipsa loquitur case. And they go on to say, we believe it is only fair that a plaintiff filing a res ipsa case be required to show early in the litigation process that his or her action actually meets the narrow res ipsa requirements. So, balancing the tension between the two statutes, this is what they came up with in terms of fairness. And Justice Hardesty pointed out that he was the dissenter in that case. One of the things that he says there is, although a retained for an object cases frequently demonstrate clear examples of medical malpractice, that's not always the case. This is that case where somebody can just come in and say, I had surgery, there was something left behind. That doesn't even satisfy the Rule 8 standards, never mind a heightened pleading standard. And I don't know that Zeidel intended to do a heightened pleading standard, but there was that compromise in there that they're saying, well, because we're creating this exception, we recognize we're creating it from NRS 41A100, which requires some evidence. And consistent with all the res ipsa cases, the court has consistently said there has to be some evidence in order for you to obtain the benefit of a rebuttable presumption. And so even at the Zeidel stage, never mind Jaramillo and Cummings, those were motions for summary judgment. But even in those cases, Justice Siglich, the complaints alleged the facts, and that's that that aspect where it says it presents facts and evidence of the rebuttable presumption. In those cases, they allege the facts, and they made sense, or you could reach those reasonable inferences, which you cannot do in this case based on this complaint. And on that basis, the court was absolutely correct in saying this case does not state a claim under res ipsa, and because it doesn't state a claim under res ipsa, then the expert affidavit requirement has to be met. And it wasn't met, and there's no question that it wasn't met. So in terms of, you know, meeting the standard, the district court absolutely met the standard. And it was not required to accept as true the conclusory allegation that there was a surgery, there's an instrument, therefore the doctor must be responsible for it. This is not...
Mercado, this is Justice Herndon in Las Vegas. I had a question, and Mr. Krakowski, you can address this if you wish at all. It's really just trying to understand a particular factual element of this. The medical records that I was trying to review weren't always of a really good quality to read what it said, but my understanding is from the 2019 surgical procedure and the 2018 scans is that whatever this object was, it was somewhere around 4 to 5 centimeters long and was actually lodged deeply into the bone. Is that correct? Such that only a couple of centimeters were removed and the rest of it was left inside the, for lack of a better word, hip bone area of the gentleman's body?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
They don't identify the object, but they say that this metal object was found embedded in the left. Remember, the first ultrasound is right upper quadrant. The other one is found in the left bone of the hip. And so, and that's true 2 years later after the surgery in 2016. And so all of those facts also give rise to the, in most res ipsa cases, you don't need an expert because it's common knowledge. This case presents situations where you're going to need an expert. You're going to need an expert to explain why isn't there any indication of any foreign object a year after the surgery. You can't just assume that the radiologist didn't know what he was doing, or, you know, the plaintiff's going to be able to explain what happened. This is an expert case. This is not the kind of case where, like in Jaramillo or Cummings, where something was left behind, admittedly left behind, you know, whether intentionally or unintentionally, so was the issue of fact. But in this case, this, you're not going to be able to resolve this case without an expert. And because he attached those complaints or those exhibits to his complaint, he created that kind of situation where he needs an expert to make this determination. This is not rebuttable presumption stuff. You cannot just tell a jury, well, look at these three imaging studies, and then you can tell whether there was negligence. That's absolutely not going to happen.
So, Ms. Mercado, this is Justice Hardesty. I just want to expand on your argument. This surgery was conducted laparoscopically with a robotic surgery. It would seem necessary to demonstrate that in that kind of surgery, and I have no idea, I'm not a surgeon, but in that kind of surgery, there's even a device of this type inserted. I think the point you were trying to make earlier in response to Justice Stiglitz is that even in a general statement, but particularly whereas here medical records have been attached, there's still a requirement that there's a cause. Causation has to be demonstrated. You can't just walk in and say, I had surgery in 1 year, and 3 years later somebody found something in my right hip or left hip, and therefore the two are connected. Res ipsa would require a demonstration that the two are connected.
And that's correct, Your Honor. And that prima facie case is not made at the motion stage. It's made at the pleading stage. And that's what's lacking in this case. And that's why, in this case, the district court said, res ipsa does not apply on this record. Therefore, an expert affidavit is required. Because there's no expert affidavit, I must dismiss under NRS 41-8071. And because of Wash Omit, I cannot grant leave to amend. He did everything that he needed to do to ensure that he complied, Judge Bressel complied, with the jurisprudence of this case on 41A071. Unless the court has any more questions, I see my...
Okay, Mr. Krakowski, your rebuttal, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start where we ended. To your point, none of us are physicians. The district court judge wasn't a physician. I'm not a physician. Ms. Mercado's not a physician. These are things that we would typically figure out during discovery, what could have happened, what the instrument is, if it's an instrument, why it happened. And again, there is no heightened pleading standard in medical malpractice cases alleging this access to the statutory presumption here.
What's your again, explanation for the use of the language by Sizedale? I know you earlier argued that Sizedale didn't do that, but it does say that there's a requirement for a prima facie showing even on the pleading stage. So whether the majority intended to modify 12b-5 or in the case of medical malpractice cases, if you're going to assert this exception, you've got to say this much more. I mean, what's your thought about that?
Sure, Your Honor. The actual language is a pretrial motion. Mm-hmm. And while we're focused on a motion to dismiss in this particular case, I believe that as we've argued in our reply brief, I believe that the appropriate interpretation of that phrase, should the court get there, despite the argument not being made, is that applies to a motion for summary judgment under Rule 56. I think the clearest indication of what is acceptable from a pleading perspective comes in Jaramillo, which Your Honor joined Justice Kadish's opinion in writing in her complaint. She pleaded facts entitling her to NRS 41A.100 sub 1 sub A's res ipsa loquitur theory of negligence. Specifically, she alleged that Dr. Ramos unintentionally left a wire in Maria's left breast following surgery. Mm-hmm. That is, in my opinion, the clearest statement of what's necessary from a pleading perspective. It's the most recent statement of what's necessary from a pleading perspective. And it's exactly what Mr. Ventura alleged in this particular complaint. A lot of these questions get to the fact that we are a notice pleading state. This court in Dutt specifically said there has never been an expectation that a plaintiff have every conceivable piece of evidence necessary to prove a claim at the outset of a lawsuit. And to that point, I think that the Ninth Circuit's opinion in Schneider, quoting the United States Supreme Court, is exactly on point. The whole intention of a Rule 12 motion is to determine whether a plaintiff should have an opportunity to elicit evidence to prove their claim. And that's exactly what I believe happened here. We need to take the allegations in favor of Mr. Ventura. Thank you.
Well, thank you both, counsel, for your excellent arguments here today. The case will stand submitted. We appreciate your briefing. And Mr. Krakowski, I want to thank you. I think you are on this case by a pro bono appointment. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, I'd like to thank you for participating in the program and admirably representing your client in the proceedings today. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, we will stand adjourned until the next call of the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.